Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And this week, I'm still popping my cork with the lovely Martin Kemp, who's walking us through the decades of his life and sharing some of the many stories documented in his brilliant new book, Ticket to the World, My 80s Stories. Now, as you may have heard in part one, he grew up in pretty poor beginnings in Islington, London, but discovered a door to a better world and a cure for his crippling shyness when he joined a local drama club. Here was the first rung to a ladder of tumultuous success as he saw himself cast in many hit 1970s TV shows and was later to join his brother Gary in his band, which went on, of course, to become one of the greatest of its time. So let's rejoin him now, mid-80s, with chart success of plenty, having just fallen in love with the woman of his dreams. There's a brilliant anecdote that you share in the book where you'd gone round to Georgia. So you've got Shirley in the car. You've just moved out of home. You and Shirley are like the sensible people from the Blitz scene. You've got a flat. Nobody else has. George is a megastar but still living with his mum,
right? That's right, his mum and dad, yeah.
And you'd gone round to drop a jacket off to him or something. And as you dropped the jacket off, he said, come in, I've just written something. What was the song that he...
Oh, it was Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. Well, he said, come upstairs, I'll play it to you. And there was a strange moment because when he said that, I thought, why didn't you play it to me the night before when we were around there, right? Because I'd left my jacket around there. And I thought, is he embarrassed about it or something? And so I go upstairs and he puts it on and I play it and I say all the right things. I say, yeah, a great record, really nice. Love that. It's going to be huge. And I go back downstairs to the car and I see Shirley waiting there and I look at her and I say, career's over. It's all done. Done and dusted. You better find something else, Shirley. It's terrible. And I really couldn't see
it.
I thought he'd blown it. Yeah. With Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. But listen, I'm really pleased that I was wrong. No, not just for him, but for Shirley as well.
I mean, in amongst all of this time, I mean, the success that you were all enjoying is huge. It really is, because there was a lot going on. Steve Norman said that of all the people to become so famous, he worried for you because you were so shy. It wasn't a natural fit for you. And yet there you were, the cover of magazines, bedroom walls. How was life as a pinup in the 80s.
It's a weird thing, that. And the older I've got, the more I look at it, because it wasn't fulfilling. You know, it wasn't like I was the one writing the songs or I was the one doing these great kind of artistic things. I was just about getting by playing the bass guitar because I wasn't that great. You know, when I first saw Level 42 and Mark King playing bass guitar, I thought, oh, no, that's the end. You know, they're going to ask me to do that. And I know at the time I was asking the question to myself, you know, what am I doing? I'm getting by on just the way I look. It's not enough. It wasn't fulfilling me at all, you know. And I didn't understand that when I was a kid, you know. And even today, you know, I think it's kind of strange, you know, in those early days, the way that my life went. And I had a great time, don't get me wrong, you know, from the first week of having a hit record, you're flying around in Learjets going to different countries, you're having a great time. But for me, it was just like, what am I? I was always asking the question, yeah. What am I? Is it just the way that I look, that I'm on the cover of the magazines, or is that enough? You know, because it wasn't artistic, what I was doing. No, it was just who I was.
I'm going to pick you up on the Learjet thing, because there's a brilliant story that you put in the book about you and Duran Duran. The night before, so you get this... So Gary, with his newfound royalties, becomes a bit of a shopaholic on the old antiques front, right? And he's on the King's Road and he's buying antiques. And Bob Geldof, who lived in that neck of the woods, runs into him one day and says, I'm doing a record for the Ethiopian famine. And you guys hadn't really been checking in on the news. You weren't hugely aware of world events at that time, beyond record sales,
we had
right?
no idea of world events at that time.
None whatsoever.
No, because we were living in the Spandau bubble. You know, this is the height of Spandau. This is 1985, which is Spandau were...
Global
touring,
success.
Yeah, touring the world, playing football stadiums. Yeah. You know, we were living inside this bubble that, you know, the most...
You weren't aware that we'd invaded the Falklands.
There was aware, you know, and we were aware of it, but the only news that you were getting at that point in 1985, if you went into a hotel room, was CNN and Bobby Batista on CNN on a 10-minute loop. Yes. So all you would see is 10 minutes and then it would start again. And you had to save that 10 minutes for the evening to sit down with your dinner. And that's the most you could
with your room service, because you couldn't go access too many fans.
You had to save it.
Yeah. So Bob comes up to Gary and he's like, look, I'm going to do this record. It's going to be like a quick... Paul has had this idea. Yeah. Paula Yates is his then wife. And Gary's like, yeah, sounds great. Give us a call, right?
Yeah.
He saunters up the road. He runs into Simon Le Bon. And Simon's like, yeah, give us a call. Count us in. Cut to the night before the recording, which is at Trevor Horn's Psalm West Studios.
Yeah.
You're on a TV show in Germany with Duran Duran, who were... your rivals at the time, right? Which you took quite seriously by all accounts.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah. I mean, chart rivals, everybody needs a rival, you know, because I was quite pleased about the whole rivalry thing with Duran Duran. You know, it's kind of Beatles and Rolling Stones, Blur and Oasis. It's part of pop culture. That's what we have.
Didn't Simon say to you once, you've got Europe, we've got America?
Yes, that's
that's
right.
That's how you divided the world up.
Yeah. John Taylor said it. And
that.
It's exactly right, yeah. and at that time... We did. That's how it works. Anyway, Bob came to us with this idea about Band-Aid. And like you said, we were in Germany. So we said to Duran Duran, OK, well, let's get back to Psalm West for 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, we've been on a heavy night out. We both get in our separate planes. And even the flight back became a race. It was who could land first.
But didn't you then book a private jet because you'd heard they'd got a private jet?
Yeah.
Is that what happened? So you even competed on that?
Everything is a race. Well, there was competition in everything we did with Duran Duran. Anyway, Bob came up with the idea with Band-Aid and said to us, get to Psalm West early in the morning and we're going to record this charity record, which it was the first of its kind, or it had been for years. You know, and the most I ever saw of any band was in the corridor of Top of the Pops. And then you didn't talk to them, you know. So it was kind of first time this had happened and got bands together. And like I said, Spandau was so in their own bubble at that time that we got to Psalm West in Notting Hill. And there were all the kids outside. They were screaming and shouting, wanted your autographs and stuff.
It was huge, right? The news was covering it.
Yeah. The news was covering it. And then one of the news reporters stopped Steve Norman, the sax player in our band, and he said to Steve, have you got anything you can say for the poor people of Ethiopia? And Steve looks at him and he goes, yeah, I'd just like to say, sorry we couldn't get down there this year, but we're trying to tour next year.
Oh, no. Good night.
And I love that, right? And I love that because it just shows how out there we were.
You know, out of touch.
Out of touch. And out, we were in our own bubble.
I know one thing was that you wanted to compete with Duran Duran on every level. So they had like a glam squad waiting for them at Heathrow. Yeah. And you were a bit knocked about that because they thought to get their hair and makeup done before they got to Sam West. Of course. And then didn't you book some big bougie Bentley or something to arrive in, which was completely badly read?
Of course. Because that's how Spandau used to travel all the time.
Really?
You know? But when we get to Notting Hill, Sam West, you know, I think... Bananarama get out of a Volkswagen, right?
Yeah.
And Paul Weller walks, yeah. Right? Spandau turned up in this great big fuck off Bentley. You know, the one the Queen would arrive in. We get it completely wrong, completely. But, when I look back at those days, right, I love it because it kind of like shows that for a while our feet got to leave the planet. You know, I spent all my years in school just dreaming of being a rock star, wanting to be in The Who, wanting to be in the Rolling Stones. And all of a sudden it happened. And there were probably 3 years that Spandau's feet left the planet. And I love that. I love it. And I'm glad that I did it. And I'm glad that I didn't know what was going on in the rest of the world, and because I was living out this complete
fantasy.
Dream. It was a fantasy. It was my fantasy that became a reality. So I'm really pleased the way that we lived. You know, we like you said, we were five boys that went to Benidorm for 10 years. We made the most of it.
Yeah, you
know,
you did.
We went through the whole gambit. We wrecked hotel rooms. We did everything that you're meant to do as a rock star, everything. And I'm glad I went through that.
So when you get to Sam West Studios and you see how other people are arriving, I think, you know, like, I think even Sting walked there himself.
Yeah, yeah, Sting walked. Yeah.
And you get inside and George is there, right, Jörg?
Yeah.
And he says to you, oh, these lyrics are a bit shit.
Well, he didn't like it. He didn't like the song. You know, I'll rephrase it. He liked the song and he liked the melody. He thought the lyrics were really depressing. Because you got to remember at the time, you know, Jörg's writing Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, right? Club Tropicana. And he said to me, I think it's all too depressing. He said, I don't think it'll work. But listen, he was as wrong as I was wrong about Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. So maybe it was 1-1 at that point.
When you're stood in that room and you're amongst your peers and the people that, you know, you'd raced back from Germany, yeah. What was that day like? Because that song still chimes every year. It's done so much good. What was it like being in the heart of that room and that moment?
It was very different. Because, like I said, you know, bands never used to mix in those days.
Mm.
You know, festivals were the realm of heavy rock bands. You never got festivals where pop bands were playing back in the day. So being in a room with all those bands together, people that you never mixed with but were your chart rivals, was very strange. And it was kind of like tense at the beginning. Until people kind of like broke the ice and started talking and started singing together. I think Tony was the first one to go and record his vocal.
God, no pressure, Tone.
Yeah. And he did an absolutely amazing job of it.
Great vocalist.
And set the kind of level where it should be at until, Bono went in and, you know, killed everybody off.
Yeah. What about the fact that Boy George was supposed to be there and Bob, right? Bob was a force. Bob makes stuff happen, right?
Yeah, yeah,
And Bob's going, right, the rest of Culture Club are there. Where's George? Where was George?
I don't know. Where was George?
He was in bed in New York.
Oh, yes, he was. Yes, right, yeah.
So he gets on the phone to him and George gets on Concorde to make it back to lay his vocals that night.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. And he did it, but, I mean, that was George, you know, at the time. You know, George at that point wasn't in the best of spaces.
He was on a lot of drugs.
Yeah, he was on a lot of drugs. So, and he will tell you that as well, you know. So it was drugs that was ruling his life, not Bob Geldof at the time. But listen, he got there in the end and he did it and he made a great job of what he did. So, I mean, it was kind of that picture of all of us sitting there that we took during Band Aid. It kind of like was... it kind of represented that period in pop, didn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it was all the big bands of that time were there.
as we traverse through the 80s, obviously professionally, life could not have been better, but also personally, you and Shirley had really hit your stride. Did you get married in the 80s? Is that when you sealed the deal?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. I'll be really honest with you. You know, it was Shirley's idea to get married. I didn't ever think that marriage was important for me, right? I love Shirley as much as I could. I didn't think, believe that marriage was going to make it any better. You know, I just thought it would... It didn't mean that much, but it meant something to Shirley. And we were living in Dublin at the time, and I was doing, which was awful, a couple of years. I was doing a tax year, you know, where you were...
So at the time, just to explain to people, you were paying 60 pence in every pound to the government.
Yeah, yeah, 65 pence in every pound, practically.
Yeah, and then you had to pay your agents on top of that. Yep. So basically, you were earning 20 pence
in every pound
that you were earning.
So, you had to change that. You couldn't carry
on with
that.
So you went to Dublin.
We ended up going there for a couple of years because we were meant to go out on tour. You know, we were meant to go out on tour of the world during this tax year. And so the first gig we go out, we play San Francisco, and Steve Norman tears a ligament in his knee.
No!
So we're still doing this tax year, and we have to find somewhere to go. So we go to Dublin. And we stayed there.
Shirley's touring the world with Wham at this point, right?
At the time,
she can't come and keep you company. No,
absolutely. So I'm stuck out in Dublin on my own. But Shirley would come to visit me every weekend. And then one weekend, Shirley comes out and we are in Grafton Street. And we walked past this old jeweller's and it's still there. I saw it just the other week when I was in Dublin. And Shirley took my hand and she pulled me into the jeweller's and said, "I want that one." And it was the engagement ring, and which I was more than happy. I was absolutely delighted with. But it was just, it was Shirley who took the lead on it. I'm so thrilled that she did, you know. Yeah.
And, you know, there she is, handling a madly successful career in her own right, which was quite unusual at the time.
Yeah.
But secretly, the moment that Shirley found out she was pregnant, that was it for her. She felt like she'd done her time of touring, and she wanted to be a mum.
Listen, Shirley was burning with motherhood. She needed it more than anyone I've ever seen anything in my life, you know. But Shirley suffered really badly from endometriosis. She couldn't get pregnant. I think this is after about 3 or 4 years, right? Shirley and I went out to St. Lucia and we decided to get married. We've been engaged for probably three years by then. We decided to get married there and then on this clifftop, which to this day, I still don't believe I'm married legally, right? It was literally one person. One person who said, "Martin, do you love Shirley? Shirley, do you love Martin? You're married."
That was it, just the two of you?
Yeah, literally.
Is that really your wedding?
Yeah, practically. And it was on a beautiful clifftop overlooking the Caribbean. It was lovely, you know. It's all I wanted. Because a few years before that, my brother had got married to Sadie Frost.
Yeah.
And I was the best man. And all the arguments that were going on about who was sitting where and who was sitting next to the cake, it was like, you know, it was bizarre. So I said to Shirley, "Right, this is it. You know, we're on our own when we get married." And so there was Shirley and I on this beautiful clifftop overlooking the Caribbean. And we go back to the room, and Shirley had been trying now to get pregnant for probably 3 years. And on our wedding night, she conceived.
Harley,
which just shows you whatever it was, being relaxed or just...
Isn't that lovely?
Yeah, no matter what it was, I don't care. We ended up with Harley, which is lovely.
The greatest gift of all.
Yeah, yeah.
So by the time we reach the end of the 80s, things are about to change significantly, right?
Yeah.
The Cray twins suddenly become a huge feature in your life in a really good way. I don't know many people that can say that. So let's turn our attention to the 90s.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
To my third and final question. I want to talk to you about the 90s, which was a decade that brought you possibly your greatest highs and also your biggest challenges.
So, was it 89 that you were cast as the Cray twins?
It was 89 with your brother? when we were cast as the Cray twins. But it took its toll on the band, that, because for a year before, people were talking about us, that we were going to get those parts and we were going to make those movies, because it was the two guys that used to produce all those expensive travelogue videos for the band were the guys that had the rights to the Cray Twin film. So it was kind of, they were talking to us about the, being in the movie. Yeah.
And obviously there's only two twins and there's five band members of Spandau.
Exactly. Yeah. So it took its toll, and I remember... the other guys weren't happy with it, and I understand why, you know, because at the time they were frightened of what was going to happen. You know, could this be the end of the band? Yeah. Because we all saw by then, by the end of the 80s, that the band was past its sell-by date. You know, we were selling fewer and fewer records every time. We were going out and playing to less and less people on those tours.
That's hard, right? That's a really hard situation to confront and face
But it happens to every band.
Yeah, of course.
And I remember Gary and I being in, this is about 87, 88, and Gary and I going down to some Bournemouth to see my mum and dad. And Gary and I were walking on the beach, sandbanks, and it was a cold kind of Sunday morning. And Gary turned around to me and said, that's it, I don't want to make any more records. I'm finished with the band. I can't carry on. I want to make my own stuff. And I begged him and pleaded with him to make one more record, you know, because I was scared, because I didn't know what was going to happen, where I was going to go afterwards. But looking back on it now, it was a mistake. We should have called it a day before that last album. We used to write music in the way that Gary would bring in acoustic guitar and then everybody would make their own parts up, and that's how the band would come together and that's how we would produce the records. But by that point, Gary was making his own demos and saying, this is how you have to play it. Copy this bit.
It changed, the dynamic changed.
On this demo, dynamic changed completely. And Gary will tell you as well, you know, he was becoming more and more domineering in the way that the band was running. You could see that Gary was the leader of the band, where before it had all been shared kind of amongst all of us. So by that time, we get to make this video for Raw, one of the tracks. And I think Gary is talking to Tony, and I can see it all kicking off. I can see the pair of them having an argument. And I go over and I said, what's it all about? And it's about that Gary had said to Tony, where are those jeans from? Are they Marks and Spencer's? And Tony said, no, they're from Gap. And that was it. It was the end of the band. Yeah, they kicked off. But it wasn't really about that.
Of course it
wasn't. It wasn't about that. It was about everything. The end of the band was about the Cray Twin film. It was about that our sell-by date had run out. It was about the end of everything. You know, our friendship.
It was a perfect storm.
And friendship being coming to a point where it was also tense, because we'd been living with each other non-stop for 10 years. We'd had, if you think about bands, that to get 10 years worth of success is really unusual. You know, even the Beatles only lasted for 6 years.
Especially at that level.
Yeah, at that level.
you know,
and it's really difficult.
Yeah.
So it wasn't the jeans that split the band up. It was everything.
Duran Duran versus Spandau. M&S versus
Gap. It was everything.
So when the movie came about, did you know? Did you have a feeling that this was going to be exciting?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I saw the... first of all, you know, when it came, the offer came to me and Gary, it wasn't kind of like we were nervous about it because... we'd had all those years of training with Anna Scher, you know, and being that young and learning something like acting when you're young, it becomes part of you. It becomes part of your personality. Mm. So it wasn't like a fear of, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm going to have to go out there and act. It was because I already knew that I could do it. Mm. I had all those years of Comedy Playhouse and Play for Today and all of that CV that was like 30 television shows long when I was, by the time I was like 15. So I knew... me and Gary both knew that we could do it. And the first thing we did when we got the offer was to go back to Anna Scher and ask Anna to give us a few lessons.
Did you?
Yeah.
How lovely.
And the first thing we did, which was an incredible call, Anna said to us, all right, I want you to get on the floor. Because she knew what we'd been through, the band had been through. We knew me and Gary had fallen out and got back together 20 times over the past 10 years, you know. And she said, I want you to get on the floor and make out you're pushing your toy cars around your mum's carpet, right? I want you to be 3 and 5 years old. And so Gary and I are on the floor making out, we're pushing these cars around, making all the sounds. But what that did, you know, was like I looked into my brother's eyes, and we were back there. We were back at 3 and 5, and all those years of arguing and all what we'd been through in the band and trying to be rock stars and, all of that, you know, breaking up hotel rooms, disappeared. And it was back to being me and Gary.
Very smart of her to do that.
Yeah, and how much we loved each other. And I think that moment, for me, is one of the most important moments in mine and Gary's relationships. And I bet you if you ask Gary that question, he'll say the same thing as well.
How brilliant that she sort of bookended such important times in your relationship as well.
Yeah.
Just something as simple as that.
What that did for us going into the Kratwin movie, it just gave us a new grounding.
Yeah.
And it made us understand. Yeah, it was a reset. Mm-hmm. And it made us understand who we were. And I think we took that with us through that film. So Gary and I, when we got that script, and everybody who was around at that point knew that it was a great script. It wasn't, you know, it would have been harder to mess that script up. Every actor in Britain wanted to play those parts.
And you wanted those parts, right? There was no, there's no
Oh, absolutely.
Doubt
well,
in your mind.
I wanted a part. I knew that it was the springboard into the next part of my life. Yeah. I knew that I was never going to be a musician that would start another band. I knew that. I wasn't a great enough musician.
And how old were you at this point?
90. I would have been about 29.
So that's still 28. A very young man.
Yeah,
Young man. So you really need, a bit like a footballer coming to the end of his playing years, am I going to do next?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But the Kratwins was, that movie and that script was the springboard into the next part of my life, and I knew that. And we made it, and it was successful. And not just box office-wise, but credibility-wise as well.
Critically acclaimed.
No, critically, it was...
Well, Hollywood came calling, really, right? You moved your entire life to Los Angeles.
Yeah, afterwards,
because you knew that there was an appetite for more from you.
Yeah.
And that's where you and Shirley... did she give birth in LA?
Yeah, Roman. Yeah, he was born in Cedar Sinai.
So you start life there with a really young family.
Yeah.
Buzzing, chapter 2, let's go.
Absolutely. You know, while I was out there, I was working as an American, you know, American accent. I was making terrible films, but that's beside the point. You know, my brother was making...
Bill got kissed in France.
Gary was making really nice ones, like The Bodyguard and stuff.
Yeah, he was in The Bodyguard.
Yeah, he was in The Bodyguard. But I was making tons of, like, C-list movies. But I didn't mind it. You know, I was out there. I was working underneath the Hollywood sign and the sun was out. And
The kids were in the pool. Everyone's
happy. The kids were
in the pool.
And I was working all the time. So, but what I was really, really pleased about, I was working as an American. So my life had changed, and I absolutely loved my time in Hollywood.
So you start the 90s with great promise. The middle of the 90s brings a diagnosis that stops everything.
Yeah.
Everything. To the point that you have to literally reset yourself physically, emotionally, mentally. I mean, it's a brain tumour.
Yeah, yeah. It was the strangest thing when I found out I had it, because I was working in Canada. And I was doing this show called The Outer Limits, which is kind of like sci-fi horror. And so I was in Vancouver, and I was playing this scientist that invented everlasting life. And instead of that, because it's, you know, sci-fi horror, it all goes wrong, and I start deteriorating at a much faster rate. So on the last scene of the day, I'm in makeup, and they have to pull this bald cap on my head and little wispy grey hairs. And as they pull the ball cap on, all I remember is that the whole of the makeup wagon go quiet, and they're looking at the back of my head that's got this lump on it. And the lump, I knew it was there, I could feel it, but it was bone. It wasn't a soft lump like you would, you know, associate with anything that was tumour-wise. It was a big lump of skull that was starting to grow out of shape. And so I flew back home the next day and went straight to the doctor, and they x-rayed it, and they found a brain tumour that was underneath the skull that had been there for about 12 years. And it was the size of a grapefruit.
Huge.
And it was, if you imagine all of that tumour being squashed in the gap between your skull and your brain, and it had no more room to move. So as it started to grow out...
It was moving the shape of your skull.
Well, the skull was protecting itself. You know, like when you break your arm, you get a little bit of extra calcium on top. On the crack. And the brain was doing that. It was starting to thicken to protect itself. And it was thickening really fast. So they called me into the hospital and they said, tomorrow you're on the operating table. And I was there for 12 hours and they cut that out. But what happened was, while they cut that one out, they found a second one that was deep inside my head.
That they couldn't operate on?
They wouldn't have known it was even there. If it would have been too late by the time they found out it was there. So when I think back to that brain tumour, that huge one that I had, it was absolutely the luckiest thing that has ever happened to me.
If you hadn't got that part wearing a skull cap on that day, who's to say that you would have given it the attention it needed?
Yeah.
Would you be sat here now saying, look at my kids, I've watched them grow up?
Yeah. But not only that, you know, it makes you realise how fragile life is, you know. But, you know, I remember the moment I wake up out of the operation and they say to me, right, we're just doing a biopsy on it to find out what it is. Is it malignant or benign? And that moment is a real flip of the coin. It makes you understand how fragile, you know. They could have come back to me and said, yeah, there's nothing we can do. But they never. They said, it's benign, we can deal with it. We want to give the second one radiation and see how you get on with that. And I was lucky. I had the radiation, and within 6 months, the second tumour that was sitting in the middle of my head started to shrink. And it's still there today, but it's tight. It's like a pea, and it's dead.
I mean, that's probably the toughest of times I can imagine that you've ever had to kind of fight your way through as a man, you know, as a human being, as a husband, as a father, but then also as a professional, right? You have you've got to restart on every level.
Well, yes, but when you're in the middle of that yourself, you're just fighting this battle to get out the other side, to come out the other side. When you come out of it, you realise the effects that it's had on everybody around you. And you realise it's my family and Shirley and everybody else that have been through the worst time. They were sitting there every day waiting for the call that I've died. Mm. And for them, it was harder, I think, you know, because I was in hospital for weeks on end. I was, most of the time, I was off my head on drugs and couldn't think straight. I was just in the middle of a battle, digging myself out of a hole. But for Shirley, she was watching me die. Oh, that's what she thought. And it was much harder for her.
Well, she was actually fighting to keep you alive. Yes. Because she was dog with a bone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she wouldn't stop until she found the right doctors.
Yeah, yeah.
With George helping her, actually.
Yeah, George
it?
And Shirley got together and searched the world, literally, phoned around the world to get the right doctor to look at the brain tumour that I had.
And the doctor was where?
And it was in Barts Hospital, that London. Was literally just up the road from me. Yeah. Which is a good job because I couldn't afford the fare at the time anyway. but listen, it was an experience in my life that I've learnt a lot from. But everybody, the question always is, so do you look at life differently? You know, and I've got to tell you, you know, after about a year, you don't. Your body wants you to get back into normal life, but your body doesn't want to remember that. No. It doesn't. You can't.
It's like holding trauma.
You can't spend your life looking through rose-tinted glasses. That's not how the world works, you know.
Well, if you thought that it was all going to end tomorrow, you'd be in a constant state of anxiety. That's no good either, right?
Yeah, yeah, of course. But my brain was completely messed up after it. You know, if I wanted to walk left, I would walk right. If I saw the door to the toilet over that side of the room, I'd go to the other side of the room.
Really?
My brain was upside down. I couldn't remember things. I couldn't remember people's names. I couldn't think straight.
So it was like a plug that had all the wires put back in incorrectly.
Yeah. Well, what it was, like loads of the wires inside my brain had been cut and squashed. So as the tumour grew down and thickened, it squashed all parts of my brain that I was using. So it took me 6 months to get over it physically. But then mentally it took me a good couple of years to get over it. And the first thing that came along professionally and work-wise was EastEnders. And when that came along, everybody was saying to me, don't touch it. You mustn't go near it, you know, because at that time, no actors with any kind of CV had gone into EastEnders, right?
With a Hollywood CV.
Yeah, it had just been a cast of people that had started the show. So everyone was saying no to me, but I knew that it was the only way that I could get myself together. And when I went up for the first audition, I couldn't even remember my lines because my brain wasn't working. It wasn't working properly at that point. So I messed up the first audition because I just couldn't remember it. But luckily enough, the guys there, they gave me a second chance. So I went back in for the second audition. And then, you know, I was there for 3.5 years.
Steve Owen was a huge character. I mean, people really, really believed you as Steve Owen to the point that some bloke punched you in the stomach and said, that's because I hate Steve Owen.
Yeah,
And they thought it was okay to do that to you in the street. In
the middle of Tottenham Court Road. You know,
Tottenham Court Road!
Yeah, took the wind out of me completely. But you have to remember at that point, you know, EastEnders was getting something like 20 million people an episode watching it. So it was in everybody's life. I had never, in all my years in Spandau Ballet, had never felt fame like I did in EastEnders.
Funny that, isn't it?
Because I think, you know, pop music is built around a certain bandwidth, a certain age width that you get from like 15 to 35, right? That listen to those pop stations on the radio and stuff and buy those magazines. EastEnders was playing from everyone from like 10-year-old kids to 90-year-old women. Yeah. And so the fame was much, much bigger. And it was something that it was hard to live with, but it was a lot of fun at the time, you know. But
you wouldn't. I don't know that you'd want that forever, though, would you?
Not at all. Not at all. You know, it's a funny thing. You know, the older I've got, the more I accept it. You know, during EastEnders, I was kind of hiding away all the time. You know, I find it hard to go out of my house. Every time I went out of my house, I wore sunglasses and a baseball cap, and I found it really difficult to live with. But the older I've got, and you realise that most people just want to say hi. And I think, you know, fame's something that if you don't accept it, it will drive you mad, you know, because it's bizarre. You know?
And what do you, I mean, when you look at Roman, you obviously, I mean, listen, it's brilliant that he's flourishing in a business that we've both loved and enjoyed so much. But I also know as a parent, your anxieties must be high because it can also be very damaging. So how do you instill upon him the lessons that you've learned about don't give it more credence than it deserves? Don't let it be too important.
Me and Roman have spoke about this a lot. You know, I've always said to Roman that Fame is a ticket to get a better job. Mm. That's all it is. You know, and the minute you start stepping outside of that, then you're in trouble. You've got to understand it's a ticket to get a better job. But you have to see as well, Roman has been around the most famous people in the world. Ro saw the best of fame and he also saw the worst of it, you know. So Roman has had the right upbringing to be famous and to understand it. And when I talk to him, you know... He's a really nice guy, Ro. He shares his fortune and he shares his luck and he shares kind of his personality with all of his friends, which is the right thing to do.
Well, when I look at Roman now and I read the pages of your book, I think, there he is. Right? He's got his own blitz scene going on.
Yeah.
And he's equipped to handle it because he's been... brought into this world by two people that really knew how to handle themselves and take the very best from what can be a very dangerous business and just remain twinkly at the end of it. And not many people get to do that. And you have, and you're remarkable for it. And I cannot wait to take to the stage with you at the Palladium. And thank you so much for sharing so much of a life incredibly well lived.
What? Yeah, too well lived. That's a problem.
You've just done the book on the 80s. I want to read the 90s.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an amazing thing. You know, I wrote that book about the 80s because it was something like, if you live through the 80s, I wanted to bring back all your memories because it was such an incredible decade. But if you didn't, then I wanted to tell those guys what it was about.
It's like an historical document for popular culture.
So I wanted to tell my story, but I also wanted to tell the story of the 80s. Yeah. You know, it doesn't go into heavy political side of it, but it kind of hits on bits and pieces of it.
But it has to, because so much of what pop culture pushes back against the politics of the time.
Yeah.
But you also touch on things like the Walkman, which was transformative for those of us that were there.
Yeah, but because everything changed here in the 80s. You know, it wasn't just politically that everything changed, but technology was growing at a rate of knots in the 80s. Like the way that Spandau, for instance, you know, when we were the gentry before we started, it was all about guitar riffs. You know, it was all about what the guitar can play.
Well, that changed quickly, right?
Yeah, as soon as the 80s came along, everybody brought in the synthesizers and you replaced the guitar riff with the synth riff. Yeah. And so, but the synth absolutely took over and it kind of set the stall out for the 80s. And as the synths grew, bands grew as well. A couple of years in, you had bands like Trevor Horn producing ABC, who their sound... today, if you put that on in a club, still sounds as bright and as new as ever because technology was changing at the rate of knots. Yeah. In the same time that music magazines was changing, in the same time that bands were changing, in the same time that all the politics were sitting in place, and things, everything in the 80s was seemed to be larger than life, you know, because it had come from the 70s. So it was a wonderful decade to grow up in. And that's kind of like... I think the reason I wanted to document it, because it felt like black and white was turning into colour.
Well, listen, you literally have poured that colour onto the page. I really loved it.
Wonderful.
I really loved it. And I hope that your kids will read it and my kids will read it.
Thank you.
And that we and that we start to celebrate the people that were so seminal of in that scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you for
Not
today.
Not at all, my pleasure.
Always fun talking to you. A huge heartfelt thanks to Martin Kemp. And don't forget, you can get his book, Ticket to the World, My 80s Story, wherever you buy your books. And you can join us as we host the Greatest Hits Party at the London Palladium on November the 25th. Tickets are available at greatesthitsradio.co.uk. And if you're in the mood for a top-up and fancy more great chat, then take a scroll through our back catalogue where you'll find episodes with Martin's son, Roman, fellow 80s superstars from the Blitz Club, Bananarama, Danny Minogue's in there, Lisa Stansfield, or if the 90s are more of your thing, then we've got Steps, Hanson, All Saints, Charlene Spiteri and Gary Barlow. My thanks to you, as always, for your company and to Maria Nibbs and the Yahoo Studios team who produced the show with me. Editing is by Eleanor Humphrey and our music is courtesy of Andy Bell, a star of the 90s, noughties and then some. You can check out his solo material as well as his work with Ride and Oasis wherever you get your music. We'll see you next Friday. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author, Elizabeth Gilbert, about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.